From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out how to forage the gardens at the IMA for a meal.
Then I will talk with artist Don Gummer about a new public exhibition of his works.
And I'll get a preview of this year's Indie Jazz Fest, and we'll have that arts calendar we call...
What'll we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Ellen Zakos wants you to take the concept of locavore food to the next level. This professional gardener has made a specialty of foraging with wild edibles very close to home, and she's coming to the Indianapolis Museum of Art to show you how to find fresh, delicious goodies right on your doorstep.
All right. It's not unusual for someone to get involved in gardening because there's a lot of beautiful stuff in nature. But how does one become a forager? Where did you start?
Well, I'm going to just steal your words and put them right back at you. It's not unusual for someone to get involved in foraging because there are so many wonderful, unbuyable flavors in nature, things that you simply cannot find anyplace else. Now, I'm just going to throw one out there because it's one of my favorite flavors. I know it grows on the grounds of the Indianapolis Museum of Art, and it's coming into season, and that is spicebush berry. Have you ever tried spicebush berry?
I have not. I think they're beautiful shrubs, but I've never had the berries.
They are beautiful shrubs, but they are also one of the single most delicious wild flavors out there. People describe it as a combination of allspice and black pepper, and that doesn't do it justice, although it may get you a little bit close. But it's a wonderful, wonderful flavor and can be used fresh or dried. Because spicebush is a dioecious plant and has, you know, male plants and female plants are separate, you want to look for the red berries that are just starting to ripen now on the female plants. And you can pick those, use them fresh, or you can dry them and use them throughout the year. I almost never use cinnamon or nutmeg or allspice anymore because that's the flavor profile of the spicebush berry. And you can only find it if you go out there and pick it.
Wow. I just had this image of a Far Side-like cartoon with all the birds who are mad at you because you're taking their berries.
Well, I always try, you know, that does bring up the question of foraging ethics. And I hear it especially when I talk about how delicious milkweed is. The fact is, whenever you forage, you don't take everything. You leave some behind for the plant to propagate itself, you leave some behind for the animals to feed on, and it's especially nice if you leave a little bit behind for the foragers who come after you.
Oh, sure. Well, that makes perfect sense. At your event that you're doing on the grounds of the IMA, well, you're actually doing more than one event. You're doing one with Just Horticulture Society members. That's a kind of morning and midday. But then the dinner that's also open to the public starts with cocktails that are made with something foraged. Can you tell us, or will you not know until that day?
Well, I have been in touch with the caterers, and I know what I've recommended. So I think I can tell you that sumac and gin will be involved. I don't want to go any further than that because, you know, you never know what might happen. But sumac is, again, a very common plant. And I like to start out with common plants that people are familiar with because that takes away the fear factor. Although, if I had a nickel for every time someone said to me, "Isn't sumac poisonous?" I would be a very rich woman.
Darn it. We'll see how we can sign you up for that.
Yeah, please do. Please let me know. I believe that one of the cocktails that will be served is called a sumac spritzer. And sumac makes a nice, tart, very pretty pink liquid that you can use in place of lemon juice. So this will be gin with a little bit of sumac juice and some simple syrup, and it'll be very light and refreshing and a little bit floral, but not like super, super sweet floral.
Wow.
Because it has that tartness to it.
Yeah. Now, I don't want our listeners to be, you know, listening to this on their phone out just randomly picking things in their yard, because there are some things that you probably shouldn't be eating. What would you advise beyond coming to the events you're doing? Where do you normally advise people to start?
Well, the first thing I say to everybody is don't eat anything if you're not 100% sure what it is.
Yeah.
You would be astonished at how many emails I get with a picture of a red berry attached that say, "What is this? It was delicious." And I just want to say, there you go, natural selection doing its work. I hope you had a nice life because it's over. And I don't say that because I try to be polite, but it's just really foolish to eat something if you're not sure what it is. And even when you do know what it is, you have to think about other things, like where you foraged. Was it near a busy road? Might it have pollutants on it? Might it have been sprayed with herbicides or pesticides? Are you allergic to something that's related to this plant that you might have a reaction to?
That's a big one right there.
Wintergreen. Pardon me?
That's a big one right there, because a lot of people are familiar with only one part of a plant family and maybe don't realize.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's why I always ask before I give out flavors or tastes of anything. I make a lovely wintergreen ice cream. Well, some people are allergic to aspirin, and if you're allergic to aspirin, some of those same components are found in wintergreen. So I won't give you any wintergreen ice cream, no matter how much you beg. you need to inform yourself, and the best way to do that is to. The very best way, I think, is to take a class or go on a plant walk with somebody like me, and then read everything you can get your hands on, everything.
Hmm. Do you travel a lot in the course of your career in your speaking engagements and so forth. Are there mm-hmm. parts of the country you haven't been to yet that you're eager to go to because you know there are edibles that maybe you haven't experienced yet?
I do travel a lot, and I love to travel a lot, and I forage wherever I go. And sometimes I travel merely to forage because I know that there's something good there. When I think about the different sections of the country, the place that I have least explored is probably the Midwest, the central Midwest. I've done some foraging up in Wisconsin and Michigan, but I really haven't done anything much south of Chicago. And I'd love to explore the Dakotas, Montana, up there, Idaho. I have a friend who lives in Boise. I think I need to invite myself up there to visit.
Yeah. I love it. In your own garden, do you grow? I don't want to be insulting, so I'm choosing my words carefully here. What I might more consider traditional edibles?
No.
Okay.
I do not. I used to, and I still thrill every time I bite into a sun-ripened, perfect tomato. But the reason I don't, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, I'm a very lazy person. I say I'm a lazy person, then people laugh. But there are only so many hours in the day. And I used to work as a professional gardener. That's what I did. I designed, installed, and maintained rooftop gardens in New York City.
Oh.
And I tell you, the last thing you want to do on the weekends when you've been gardening for somebody else for 5 days is work in your own garden.
Right.
It's the old, you know, cobbler's kids have the worst shoes.
Right, a
scenario.
Busman's holiday, not very pleasant, yeah.
Exactly. So that's why I first stopped growing vegetables, traditional vegetables. And then the more interested I became in foraging, the more of a full-time occupation it became. Yesterday I was out in the mountains and I hit the mother lode with a couple of different kinds of mushrooms. So many mushrooms that the bag literally broke. Yes, it broke. It was so heavy.
Wow.
But then you get it home, and the job isn't done. Now I have to clean all of those mushrooms, and I have to dry some of them, and some of them I have to saute and freeze. So there's a lot of work that goes with preserving your wild harvest. And I find that between that and my writing work, that takes up just about all of my time.
Absolutely.
There's not a lot left for planting a traditional vegetable garden.
Yeah. Do you have, can you give us some hints about the menu for the program you're doing in Indianapolis, the main meal?
I would if I could, but I have no idea what they've decided on. I've suggested certain foraged elements that they use, and the caterers were very nice on the phone and really open to the ideas and the flavors that I was describing, but I have not spoken with them since, so it will be as much a surprise for me as it is for everyone else. But I can tell you that on the walking tour that we're doing during the day, I will be baking some cookies in advance with some foraged items that I know are on the ground, so that I can say to people, you see that spice bush there? Here, this is a spice bush snickerdoodle.
Whoa.
Do you taste that? That's what that berry is. So I'm thinking spice bush snickerdoodles, maybe some wild ginger snaps, which are superb. You know, I shouldn't say that about my own cooking, right?
Now, wait a minute. So I've often wondered that I'm a gardener, but not a super experienced one. So ginger that we grow as kind of a ground cover or a shade plant here, is part of ginger snaps?
The underground stolons. If you've ever transplanted any ginger in your garden, you know that each plant is connected to the one next to it by this network, extensive network of underground stolons. And those have a wonderful flavor that's somewhat darker than tropical ginger, but equally complex. It's warm, it's spicy. I love it. And the way that you harvest that is you dig up the entire patch carefully of your ginger, and you snip the connecting stolons so that you can then replant each ginger plant, because you leave the roots and some of the stolons on it. It will continue to grow, and you just remove the sort of interconnections. And then you bring those back into the kitchen, and you can use those either fresh or dried. They work wonderfully with both savory things like dry rubs and marinades. They're great in sweet dishes like cookies or apple or pear pie. And I will confess, I've started using it in cocktails as well, infusing vodka and gin with the ginger, also making a ginger syrup that I use as a cocktail ingredient. It's a great flavor.
I think
come for the walk. You can taste it.
Yeah, I think you're altering my Thanksgiving meal plans as we're speaking.
Yeah.
Wow. What do people normally, what are people most surprised by when they first go with you on a foraging walk?
Do you mean what plant are they most surprised by?
Yeah. Or just in general?
I think one of the plants that almost universally surprises people, although it won't surprise them much longer because I talk about it a lot, is hostas. I think a lot of people are truly surprised that hostas are not only edible but quite delicious when they're young and tender before they unfurl all the way in the spring. So if I'm doing a spring plant walk, I love to show people hostas and how to harvest them so that they can still be attractive in their garden, but they can bring some indoors to eat. Dahlia tubers is another one that surprises people.
Hmm.
Daylily tubers also surprises people. Those are three off the top of my head that I think people find very interesting.
And with hostas, for a lot of Midwestern gardeners, there's that additional advantage of, I got to it before the deer did.
Yes, there's a degree of satisfaction in that, in knowing that you beat the deer at their own game. Of course, they'll eat them long after they're too fibrous for me to be interested. But in the early spring, as they're just poking up, they are wonderful, roasted or sautéed in a little bit of butter or olive oil, very tender and a nice fresh green flavor.
Sharon Gamble with gardener, writer, and photographer and forager Ellen Zakos. Ellen will speak about backyard foraging at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, September 29th at the DeBrost Lecture Hall at the IMA. The talk is free and open to the public. Earlier in the day, Zakos will lead a group of Horticultural Society members in a members-only foraging trip on the IMA campus. And at 5:30 on Thursday, September 29th, the museum is offering a harvest evening buffet dinner at the Deer's Ink Pavilion. You can learn more about all these events, including how to become a member of the Horticultural Society, at imahortsoc.org. That's imahortsoc.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Don Gummer Back Home Again is an exhibition of 8 sculptures by Indianapolis native, New York-based artist Don Gummer. Located on the Indianapolis Cultural Trail, the show runs from now through next August. It's presented by the Central Indiana Community Foundation in honor of the Indianapolis Foundation's 100th anniversary and in partnership with the Indianapolis Cultural Trail, Inc. Travis DiNicola spoke with Gummer and curator Mindy Taylor Ross about the exhibit.
Mindy, Don, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you both here.
Thanks, Travis. Great to be here.
Thanks, Travis. Great to be here.
Absolutely.
Nice
absolutely.
Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, too. You know, I'll just say that I got to interview you in 2004 when Southern Circle was installed here, just sort of south of the Slippery Noodle. And that was it's a great piece, and it was a great opportunity to interview you then. And so glad to have you back in town.
Oh, well, thank you. It was an honor to do it, and it was great meeting you back then.
Thank
2004.
You. Yeah, it's one of the few interviews I got to do where it was not in the studio, but actually out on location, which was a lot of fun.
Oh,
yeah. Mindy, I want to start with you just to give us a little background here on how this came about, because you've been working with CICF and with Don to curate this and make this possible, this year-long exhibition of Don's work along the cultural trail.
Yes. Yeah, so Don Gummer Back Home Again is an exhibition of 8 large-scale sculptures that will be in the city for a year, so through August 7th of 2017. And it's being presented by the Central Indiana Community Foundation as part of the celebration of 100 years of philanthropy through the Indianapolis Foundation. So it's part of the great celebration of the last 100 years, but a lot of these art projects like Enlighten and like Don Gummer Back Home Again are also about setting the pace for the next 100 years.
That's very exciting.
Yeah.
So without embarrassing Mr. Gummer too much, why was it so important to have Don's work here as part of this, to feature him for this?
Well, I think it's about wanting to celebrate inspiring places, which, of course, is an important initiative and quality of life initiative for the Central Indiana Community Foundation. But to be able to do that with an internationally renowned artist who grew up here in Indianapolis, graduated from Ben Davis High School, and started his formal art education here at the Heron School of Art and Design. It was a way to sort of tie in, bringing a native home and celebrating his international career and kind of tying it back to the place.
That's a very cool thing.
Yeah.
Don, it is great to have so much of your work on display here. I mean, as I mentioned, we've got Southern Circle, which is a permanent piece here. Some of your work is on display at the IMA. But to have 8 of these sculptures along the cultural trail is really exciting. How did you choose which ones to go with? And did you pick them specifically for each site along the trail, or how did that play out?
We, together with Mindy, mm-hmm. picked a group of 8 pieces, and knowing which 8 we had in mind, we drove around the city to different areas of the cultural trail, and together we came up with what we thought made sense in each location.
Tell me a bit about the works themselves. I mean, I look at them, and each one is very distinct, but there's a common sort of style and theme that I see of whether it be a specific shape or idea that gets replicated and sort of builds on itself from a small base growing up in many cases.
That's pretty perceptive. Yeah, that's pretty much most of my work starts, not small, but it expands. Mm-hmm. Whatever I start with, it usually expands as it increases in height. And that's, I guess, goes throughout most of my work.
There's a real sense of almost each one growing up and you know, getting taller and expanding. I mean, you can sense that movement.
Yeah, I think of trees a lot, you know, a strong center core, and then it goes up from there and tries to. Sometimes I'll start something that has a lot of irrational decisions and shapes and things. Mm-hmm. And then as it rises up, it clarifies itself and then comes to not a complete conclusion, but some some point. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Why go up any higher?
So okay. That. How tall are most of the pieces that are going to be on display?
I think the average, if you average them out, they'd be about 10 feet, maybe okay. 12 feet high. There's ones, the biggest one is
it's 14 feet.
14 feet.
Yeah.
And then the material, is it mainly steel or?
They're steel. They're stainless steel, mm-hmm. aluminum, and stained glass. Mm. It's pretty much one piece has Corten steel in it.
Spanish guitars, bronze.
Spanish yeah. guitars, bronze. Yeah, bronze, stainless steel, stained glass.
Which is the one that, to me, it sort of looked like chair backs stacked on each other, kind of almost like single parallel pieces kind of in a box form that were built onto each other, kind of a white piece. Which one's that?
Where did you see it in?
It was on the website.
Could be either open house or it could be intersection, and those really relate to haiku poems, right, mm-hmm. Don?
Those are haiku. Yeah, I did a show in New York with nine sculptures along Broadway from 59th Street, Columbus Circle, up to Harlem. There's plazas above each subway stop.
Mm-hmm.
So to connect the pieces on for that show, I was thinking of haiku poetry. Instead of using syllables, I use shapes.
Okay.
So the bottom tier, there are three tiers because of the three lines of haiku.
Sure.
So the bottom tier has five shapes, and then there's a horizontal element between the bottom and the middle that to me is like paper, lined paper. It's very flat. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing that's totally flat. Or horizontal, and then seven shapes in the middle sentence, you know, part of the sculpture, and five in the top.
Neat. That's great.
So, and I would write a haiku. I wrote haikus for each one, but mm-hmm. they're not.
You know what they are, but we don't.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a good example of trying to do, like, site-specific or site-sensitive installations. Mm-hmm. That piece, for example, is called Intersection, and we installed that actually last night mm-hmm. outside the city-county building directly across the street from the new transit center.
Oh, great.
A great piece, Spanish Guitar, is going to be installed outside the Indiana Repertory Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when we were going around, Don telling me about remembering going up there during high school, I think, for a dance. And so having something that relates to music relates to sort of Picasso and art history there yeah. in front of the Repertory Theater was, we liked that juxtaposition. So.
Well, of course, as soon as you said Spanish guitar, Picasso is what I first thought of.
Yeah.
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 yeah. No, I did that piece when I lived in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Had a studio there. So I did a few riffs on classic Picasso pieces.
Nice.
So in that particular piece, it doesn't grow up and expand as it goes up because it's more about a specific thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's much different from Picasso's guitar.
Yes.
And that's the oldest piece in the show from 1992. Hmm. So the eight examples span 20 years of his career.
Excellent. Yeah. So just from a technical standpoint, I mean, how are these being installed on the trail so that they, you know, are safe and don't topple over and all that sort of stuff?
Well, I had an engineer go over each one.
Mm-hmm.
And how many? Four? Are from Broadway, so they've been pre-engineered
yeah,
already,
and, for this type of installation.
I wanted to make something that was easy to install,
mm-hmm.
that wouldn't topple over in the wind, or if a car hit it, or a bus, I guess, could knock mm-hmm. it over. But people could climb on.
But we don't
not supposed
climb the sculpture.
To climb. And, yeah, just so we could plop them down, level them, and they're simple to install and remove. They don't interfere, no footings or anything like that.
What does it mean for you to – I mean, of course, you've had huge shows all over the world talking about this one in New York. But to be invited to, you know, essentially back home to, you know, where you grew up, to be a part of this celebration that CICF is doing and to be on the cultural trail in this way, I would think got to have some sentimental significance.
It's very cool. It's something yeah. kind of almost too, like, is this the end of something? Or, you know, you think, am I going back? And is that – but – the opportunity, I was presented with the opportunity, and I really like the idea. I like mm-hmm. My family still lives out on the west side in Plainfield and Avon. And so it's just a nice connection to make and come back and to, in a way, to thank Indianapolis
yeah.
for kind of what it meant to me. when I was at that age, just beginning my career as an artist, you know, getting that identity of an artist.
Indianapolis has certainly changed a lot since you were beginning your career as an artist here in many positive ways, I think. Have you had a chance to, you know, get to sort of rediscover the art scene here?
I have. When I left here, the museum was still on 16th Street.
Mm-hmm.
So to see that blossom and become a great museum and to see all their collection finally, you know, and the new art school, mm-hmm. the new IUPUI campus, that whole part of the canal thing and all that was, that's all to me new.
Yeah.
Because right before I left, I worked as a brakeman on the New York Central Railroad, and I remember making trains through tracks and where now the canal is, or right near, you know, next to the canal, and they've taken out a lot of those tracks. So it's good to see.
It is.
You see progress.
Absolutely. Mindy, this has got to be an exciting project for you to work on. You've been involved with so many different public art installations and exhibits and events over the years, but this is a pretty significant one for you, I'd imagine.
It is. It's a great opportunity to follow up on those projects I started back in 2005 with the Indianapolis Cultural Development Commission, but it's especially special.
Mm-hmm.
There you have it. For me to work with Don,
you two have worked together before.
That's right. I actually worked with Don when I was a gallerist in Southwest Florida, and so this was an opportunity for us to work together again. We've actually known each other for about 16 years. So it's a great kind of coming full circle for me as well.
Well, congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank
you.
Yeah,
absolutely. And congratulations to you, Don. It's a real pleasure to be able to have your work in town for so long and for people to be able to enjoy it so much and in a really interesting way, having it outside on the trail. And thank you for taking the time to come in to Art of the Matter today.
Yeah, well, thank you. And thanks for having us here today. It's been great.
Travis DiNicola with artist Don Gummer and curator Mindy Taylor Ross. You can see the 8 sculptures located on the Cultural Trail now through next August. For a map and more information, visit dongummerindy.com. That's dongummerindy.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You don't have a lot of work scheduled for this weekend, do you?
No, why yes?
Because it's
Labor Day weekend. Of course it is.
And we have a lot of events that you can participate in or watch or consume to rest from your labors.
There you go.
It's part of our calendar that we call
What Do We Do?
Labor Day 2016
Labor Day
edition.
Weekend.
That's right.
Well, I strongly urge you.
Yes.
If you have not yet, to go out to the IMA, or to the zoo, let's try that again. Well, you should go to the IMA, too. The IMA is great. But check out the zoo, because in the gardens at the zoo, this is the last weekend for all the amazing Sean Kenny's Nature Connects art with Lego bricks. I went and got to see it last weekend, and it is stunning. I mean, the pieces that take literally like hundreds, in some cases thousands of hours to create, with hundreds of thousands of pieces of Legos. And I mean, many people have seen the gorgeous pictures already of the polar bear mother and the three cubs, which is outstanding. But there's some other pieces there, like a snow leopard, which is one of the most gorgeous things I've seen, or the huge hummingbird that's on a trumpet flower, and the beautiful coral reef and seahorses. There's 12 different sculptures, and they're all throughout the White River Gardens and absolutely worth checking out. They'll give you a map and you can walk around, and the gardens are, many flowers are in bloom right now, and so it's lovely as well, but really worth checking out. If you haven't seen it, this is the last weekend for it.
It's kind of a math and engineering kind of puzzle.
Oh, it's a marvel.
To figure out, you know, how all these creatures were plotted out and how many pieces and what colors and so forth. Hey, speaking of sculpture, congratulations to the Indianapolis Foundation on its 100th anniversary
Enlighten Festival last weekend that put light sculptures all around the west side of downtown, from Scottish Rite Cathedral to the canal. And I saw a lot of chatter on various social media about, ooh, let's make this an annual event. Well, let's let them catch their breath over at Indianapolis Foundation and CICF first. But congratulations, all well done, and great, great turnout. All kinds of people downtown to celebrate in the light.
Beautiful stuff. Mm-hmm. Very, very cool stuff. It's great that they did that. Hope we can see it again sometime.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. Hey, just to give you a heads up, that's the Vonnegut's World, a week-long festival exploring what makes Vonnegut Vonnegut, is going to be starting up next week on Wednesday the 7th. Starts with a panel discussion opening celebration at the Indianapolis Arts Center. At 5:30 reception, 6 p.m. panel, including people from the opera and different people who have put together this new operatic piece, and also the Vonnegut Memorial Library Director of Education, Max Goller. They'll be talking about Vonnegut and the world premiere of Happy Birthday, Wanda June. And then following on the 8th, Butler University's theater department is doing a play reading. And then there's going to be a showing of Slaughterhouse 5 at the Basile Center. And there's going to be the music of Kurt Vonnegut on the 10th, and the brunch of champions on the 11th down at Bluebeard Restaurant, which is great.
Cute.
Is that great?
Yeah. It's
very clever. And then a sort of a preview roundtable performance of the opera at Indy Reads Books on the 12th. And then it all leads up to the world premiere of the opera on the 16th. Lots of great stuff going on. You can check all this out. If you just do a search on Vonnegut and Vonnegut's World, you'll find the whole schedule.
And if you are intrigued by that, I urge you to go to WFYI.org and listen to the interview Travis did last week with Kevin Patterson, the director of the Indianapolis Opera, and composer Richard Alden Clark, who was friends with Vonnegut and had a very long gestation period for turning one of Vonnegut's works into an opera. So very cool.
Very cool project.
Yeah, indeed. If you like ghosts, you like ghosts? You're kind of into things from other dimensions. this Friday night at 8:30, Haunted Indianapolis. Well, you know, magic. I don't think we should go too much further down that trail. Haunted Indianapolis Downtown Ghost Walk is happening this Friday night at 8:30. You can learn more at unseenpress.com. It's offered by a Westfield-based company that does ghost walks year-round, but fall could be the best time to experience a spooky tour.
Very cool.
Indeed. Learn more at unseenpress.com.
And speaking of tours, if you're still looking for maybe a great road trip, a day trip for this Labor Day weekend, the Indiana State Museum has put together on their website 12 great day trips around Indiana that include going to Angel Mounds or the Court and Capitol, Historic New Harmony, finding out about Gene Stratton Porter, going to the Lanier Museum, lots of neat stuff, the Levi Coffin House, Limberlost, there's a T.C. Steele tour, and all of this is on the Indiana State Museum's website. Check that out, and you can get some history and get some great maps to plan your road trip for this weekend.
Much closer to home next weekend, you have two great choices on Saturday, and if you play your cards right and get a good night's sleep, you can probably do both of them. Don't forget, it is Indiana's nicest day, the Penrod Arts Fair Saturday.
And you're going to be there,
September
Sharon.
September 10th, I'm going to be there.
You're going to be there without me.
Aww. I'm trying not to think about it. Stop it.
Okay,
Shut up. Mm-hmm. That's from 9 to 5 at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, and it's a special anniversary this year, so some extra special goodies out there. And also, the French Market at St. Joan of Arc Church, which goes from noon to 10, so you could theoretically go to Penrod, save some energy, and go on over to St. Joan of Arc at 42nd and Central and eat some lovely French food and hear some lovely music. And also, you can attend a Mass in French at 5:30 next Saturday at St. Joan of Arc. So,
ooh la la,
something for everyone.
Here's something for everyone. Coming off of their great performance of Carve at the Fringe Festival, Modus Dance is again offering belly dance classes this fall with a Thursday night lineup with beginner belly dance classes and belly dance drills and techniques and belly dance choreography. There's different 5-week sessions. For the beginners, you do have to register ahead of time, no drop-ins, but they do allow drop-ins for the other classes. Find out more at the Modus Dance Belly Dancing.com website about belly dancing this fall.
All right. Is it women only? Can men do it? Does it say?
You know, that's a very good question.
I don't know that I've ever seen a male belly dancer.
No, I think I don't know that. But why not?
Why not?
Why not?
If you become the first one, tell us about it. Hey, if you like vintage cars, listen up. On September 16th at Connor Prairie, there's another one
of their great car events.
Vintage Wheels and Wine
at
Connor Prairie. And you're sure to see, I've gotten a sneak preview of some of those cars. If you like classic cars, you need to check this out. You can go to ConnorPrairie.org to find out more about that. That's September 16th.
Yeah, and they're doing a whole festival of machines then following that on the 17th and 18th. And that's going to be really cool. There's some old Bentleys and a Shelby Cobra Roadster. And that's going to be an awesome show. Very cool stuff at Connor Prairie. Hey, I want to give you a heads up. On Friday, September 2nd, Gallery 924 is going to be presenting Appropriated Voyeurism, which is an interactive multimedia installation by Indianapolis artist Phil O'Malley. It should be a really interesting show of Phil's work. It sounds a lot different from his usual work of very abstract, beautiful paintings. And for this, he's creating a big installation, which is something different for him. 50-foot long, sort of curvilinear multimedia. There's painting and other things and images and fiber optics and sound and all types of stuff. Should be very cool to check out at the Gallery 924 on Pennsylvania Street with Phil O'Malley. And of course, you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website, or listen to Sharon and I next week on that calendar we call
What do we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
This year, Indie Jazz Fest is doing a tribute to Native son Wes Montgomery. Sharon Gamble invited Jazz Fest Artistic Director Rob Dixon to share some highlights of this multi-venue celebration and to tell us what he personally has learned from recordings of Wes Montgomery.
How does Wes Montgomery influence you? Because his instrument couldn't be more different from yours. But it's not just a one-to-one correlation, right? You can still be influenced by fellow jazz musicians, even if what they play is completely different from what you play, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Usually, like when, I guess, musicians first start out playing jazz, they definitely look at a particular instrument that they play to say, what is the definitive sound of jazz of the saxophone? Mm-hmm. And so initially I look to like Charlie Parker and John Coltrane and Sonny Rollins. But, once I got into the genre, I started listening to a lot of trumpet players, guitar players, piano players, and definitely Wes Montgomery holds the distinction of being the definitive modern jazz guitar player. I mean, if you think of a small group, I mean, the first person you think of when you say jazz guitar is Wes Montgomery.
Yeah.
So I guess in that respect, his music, his compositions, you know, I've played the compositions in various groups and so and been influenced by his music and his writing style. And then I've actually got to play with a lot of guitarists, and if we play music, particularly his music, he's had his lines. One of the things that he had a lot of times, he'd have different group members playing the single note melodies together, so they had a really clean sound. And there's a really cool sound when you have a tenor saxophone with guitar playing the melody, and I've had a chance to do that. And when you play some West tunes, it sounds like the tenor saxophone was made for that voice to be matched with the guitar. So
wow, cool, and cool texture together too.
Yes, definitely a nice, rich, warm, you know, texture with some point on it.
So this is Local Boy Makes Good story. Can you remind us how he got into jazz even to begin with?
Wes actually started playing jazz guitar late in life at age 19,
And did he play something else before? Do we know?
You know, I'm not really sure. I know that he was probably. I know his, both of his brothers play instruments, and then it was and you know playing starting a guitar. Well, starting an instrument at age 19 is kind of late. I don't
absolutely.
But what's kind of remarkable about his situation, like within less than 5 years, he was on the road with Lionel Hampton, his big band, and he played. You know. I mean, I guess he got started just emulating Charlie Christian and being picked up by the Lionel Hampton Big Band. I mean, that was probably one of the most popular big bands at the time, you know, because Lionel Hampton had the association with Benny Goodman and that group, and Benny Goodman was probably the most paid, well-paid entertainer of the 20th century when you compare the value of the dollar. But playing with Lionel Hampton, he did that for 2 years, and I think that set his career up for, you know, I think what he could do in the industry. So when he came back to Indianapolis, he formed groups, and I think he would practice a lot with different musicians around the city. And I think around 1959, maybe, it was Cannonball Adderley came into town and was playing. Legendary saxophonist, and he heard Wes Montgomery was just blown away. So he got on the phone with Orrin Keep News, who's producer of Riverside Records. And a few days later, the Wes Montgomery Trio was recording in New York City.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and you know, it was pretty remarkable, too, because, I mean, I of course, I've read a lot about this Wes Montgomery, but I had the fortunate pleasure of working with Melvin Ryan for a number of years, who was a part of the original Wes Montgomery Trio. So not only did I read about it, I get to hear stories firsthand about like what they went through and how Wes's career took off from that time.
That's amazing.
Right. And Melvin said that they did that record, A Dynamic New Sound, for Riverside Records. But he said it was that second record that really just kind of set Wes Montgomery on fire. It just like made him, you know, in the jazz community, it just kind of like a bolt of lightning shot across the world. Like he was the definitive guitar player. And that was the second record he made. And I think it was called The Incredible Jazz Guitar of Wes Montgomery was the title of that album. And from then on there, I think it was just like, it was just a domino effect of where he would start recording all over the country, working in San Francisco, working in New York, Los Angeles, recording in different scenarios. I mean, in a 10-year I think in a 10-year period, he recorded over about 35 records, albums.
Thank goodness. And I of course, we never know what's inside somebody's head, but you know, he didn't even live to be 50. He had a really short life.
Right.
He
so lived it was to like, be 45
it was
years
like
old.
Maybe something in him drove him and said, do it, right. do it now. Get it.
Yeah, I mean,
get your work out there.
Yeah, for somebody to start essentially playing the guitar at 19, 20, and then he passes at 45 within less than 25 years,
yeah.
almost 20, inside 25 years, he, you know, became the world's greatest jazz guitarist.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's pretty remarkable in itself.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, yes, definitely.
So I imagine you that's a you plural. The behind the scenes of Jazz Fest have been saying for a few years, well, at some point we want to do a tribute year to Wes Montgomery.
Yes. The thing about Indianapolis is there's so many legendary, iconic musicians,
yeah.
jazz musicians that
yeah.
come from here. So it's like we have pick up the litter to choose. You know, a few years ago we did something on J.J. Johnson,
yeah.
and then we did a Freddie Hubbard tribute, and now we've come to do Wes Montgomery. And all these musicians have had such a profound influence over the genre of jazz across the world. You know, so
yeah,
it's I've heard this from a lot of people lately that Indianapolis doesn't brag enough about what we have in the city.
You're hearing that when you go out touring nationally and internationally? Is that what you hear?
No, I just hear it in the...
Or you hear it here.
I hear it here, but, you know, yeah. We need to stop being so modest. I mean, you know, when you go to New Orleans, the one thing, they have a great music scene, they have a great culture, but they are not modest. They definitely tell you this is where it's happening. And, you know, I think that has gives them results, you know, if you say, hey, you make a declarative statement, this is the place for music where music is happening, and people will say, okay. So I think that's what we need to start doing in Indianapolis. This is a place for culture and music. And
and the programming of this Jazz Fest says that loud and clear. And once again, you're in venues all around town, from Central Library, Indiana Landmarks Center, Speedway. But I want to talk about you kind of and we also, and this is probably a conversation for another time, not just during the weeks of the festival, but you actually are a year-round enterprise. But I want to talk about the sort of the opening and closing events. You've got a Let's Get Excited party on Thursday the 15th, and that is that a little bit of a sampler then, musically?
Yeah, we'll have basically all the events are kind of a tip the hat to West Montgomery, mm-hmm. so everything is going to kind of is West centric. You know, West Montgomery influence. So we'll have a music group that is kind of like, basically par for the course of what is going to happen on the next few days. We'll have a jazz group that is guitar-based at the Indiana Landmark Center. And we'll just tell, you know, have, a number of, media people there and just telling people about what's happening that week.
Getting people ready.
Yeah, getting people excited, right?
And then at the end, a block party at the Jazz Kitchen on September 24th. And Yat's Food and 11 bands on two stages. I don't know how everybody's going to have any energy by that point to do that, but that's awesome.
I know we've done block party, I think, this will be the third year, I think, that we've done it. And it's been successful the first year and second year, and it just seems like it's something that everybody looks forward to now. This is kind of like, the let your hair down, have fun day.
Kind of the after party, right?
Right, the after party.
You've got so many interesting artists coming, but I want to make sure we talk about Saturday the 17th, which is West Montgomery Tribute Day at IUPUI. Tell us about that.
Okay, so the West Montgomery Tribute Day is we're having a number of nationally known and renowned guitarists coming to participate. We have the legendary Pat Martino Quartet, and we have the Russ Malone Quartet, and Dave Stryker, Fareed Hawk, Chuck Loeb, Bobby Broom, Henry Johnson, Will Matthews, and all these guitarists. And we have Indianapolis native Royce Campbell, as well as the Indie Guitar Summit, and some great indie-based groups like the Tucker Brothers Quartet and Charlie Ballantyne and Patrick Wright, all guitar players. So we have all these phenomenal guitar players that are going to play and give a tribute to West Montgomery in their own way. Maybe.
And you've got sort of celebrating the educational part of Indie Jazz Fest's mission. You've got high school and college kids and kind of an educational piece.
Right, we have a number of high school groups performing. A group, the Butler Youth Jazz Ensemble, which is a high school based group. The Indie Jazz Futures, which is a high school. Indie Jazz Fest, Jazz Futures, which is a high school.
You coach based. Them, don't you?
Yes. I'm the director of that ensemble.
Yeah.
And then we have, quartet or maybe a quintet from Carmel High School, as well as a group from Bloomington. So there'll be a lot of, and of course the IUPUI. Jazz Ensemble, which I'm the director of, too, so I'm excited about them performing.
Yeah. If you can't find something during Jazz Fest to be psyched about, you're not paying attention, right? There's just something for everybody. And a lot of local focus.
And we have one of your colleagues, Mr. Kyle Long, who's going to be a part of it.
Absolutely. And also, if you are a piano fan, remember Sullivan Fortner just kind of blew people away and is here with the Sullivan Fortner Trio at the Jazz Kitchen in the festival. And also a singer and guitarist named Alan Harris, who's going to be at the Cabaret at the Columbia Club.
Right.
That's intriguing to me. I'm not familiar with Alan Harris. Tell me.
Alan Harris has definitely become a prominent cabaret jazz singer in the last few years. So we were excited to have him. And basically, he is not well known to Indianapolis, but I think that he will be, once he gets here.
That's going to change.
Right. I mean, much like when we had, a few years ago, we had Trombone Shorty. A lot of people didn't know who Trombone Shorty was, and now the Indianapolis community knows who they are.
There we go.
Yeah, so.
And Tony Bennett said Alan Harris is his favorite singer. So
right.
Nothing like getting some good press from a legend.
Definitely. We have a lot of exciting music that is happening. Of course, you know, Robbie Coltrane, John Coltrane's son, tenor saxophonist, and a big concert at the Walker Theater, Norman Brown, which is on the 16th, and I think that will be well attended, and Norman Brown puts on a great show, so we're excited about that.
Sharon Gamble with Indie Jazz Fest Artistic Director Rob Dixon. Jazz Fest runs from September 15th through the 24th at venues around town. Jazz Fest will also have a stage at the Penrod Arts Fair at the Indianapolis Museum of Art on Saturday, September 10th. And you can learn lots more and plan your jazz binge at IndieJazzFest.net. Again, IndieJazzFest.net.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when it will be an all-Sharon show.
Woohoo! First, I'll check out a new book of Indiana road trips. Then I'll get a preview of the upcoming Actors Theater of Indiana season. And finally, I'll check in on this year's Irish Fest. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.